the fact that you're questioning your ability as a parent, the fact that you're struggling in and of itself, just frame it differently. It's evidence that you are a good parent because you're caring.
Hello, my dear friend. Welcome back to another episode of the Curious Neuron Podcast. My name is Cindy Huffington and I am your host. I am a mom of three from Montreal, Canada, and I have a PhD in neuroscience. My goal here with Curious Neuron is to help you, the parent, nurture your emotional and psychological well-being. The reason why I think it's so important is because if we are not well, it is very difficult for us to take care of our children. We can't nurture them if we are not nurturing ourselves. And the more I spoke to parents the past couple of years as I was sharing the information I was through Curious Neuron, which was initially focused on the child, I realized that I can give you all the information you want on children, but if I don't give you some information about yourself and if I don't help you nurture yourself, then what's the point of the other info? You need to start with you. And today's episode focuses on new parents. Actually, you don't have to be a new parent. It could be your second child, your third child, your fourth child. But if you are expecting a child or if you've had a child recently, then this episode is for you. I'm doing something a little bit different today where I have two guests. One is somebody who's had this lived experience and these struggles with mental health. And the other is a researcher and clinician from McGill University here in Montreal. Before we do move on to the episode, I'd like to thank the Tannenbaum Open Science Institute here at the Neuro for sponsoring the Curious Neuron podcast, as well as the McConnell Foundation, who is also sponsoring the podcast. Without these two organizations, this podcast would not be possible. So thank you. And also thank you to you for subscribing to the podcast, for downloading and listening to the podcast. And if you haven't done so yet, please take a moment to leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening to it, whether it's Apple or Spotify or Audible, because doing all of these things is exactly what allows people to know that you want more. And I hope you do, because I enjoy doing this very much. If you haven't done so yet as well, I have the link in the show notes for my Reflective Parent Journal. If you are looking for a resource that can guide you in your thinking from work-life balance to the relationship with your child, to your own values, to your relationship with your partner, then this journal will give you reflection prompts to help you think through and problem solve these relationships and these challenges that you might be having in your life. I've already started booking school workshops for next August and September. So if you work at a preschool or at a school, whether it's elementary school or high school, and you want to support the well-being of the educators and the teachers, this could be through conflict resolution or emotion regulation training. I offer workshops both in person and on Zoom. So you can email me at info@curiousneuron.com. All right, so today we are focusing on a term that Dr. Montreuil and I were having a conversation, and we realized that we needed to really focus our conversation around this when it comes to mental health, and the word was normalizing. I think that it's very important for us to keep talking about experiences that we've had with our mental health, because that helps to normalize it and people feel that they're less alone. Because sometimes when we're struggling with our mental health, we feel that we are the only ones going through this. So that aspect is very important. However, sometimes it could kind of go in the wrong direction, in the sense that when we are normalizing something too much, we might not be being proactive, and we might not be taking the necessary steps in order to support ourselves or take care of ourselves in a way that we should. And that's the conversation that we are having today. So I have Nathalie, who's going to be sharing her journey with her postpartum mental health. And I've brought on a guest that has already been here. This is somebody that I did my PhD with and respect her so much. She is doing such fascinating work at McGill. Dr. Tina Montreuil will be joining us as well. Dr. Montreuil is an associate professor at McGill University in the Department of Educational and Counseling Psychology. She is the director of Childhood Anxiety and Regulation of Emotions Laboratory, called CARE. That's a research group. She's the principal investigator of Montreal Antenatal Wellbeing Study, the associate member of Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences in the Department of Psychiatry. The list goes on. She's a scientist at the MUHC here in Montreal, and she is just doing such important work. And I'm really glad that she agreed to come back on this podcast and that we are launching this episode on the week of maternal mental health, which is the week of April 29th, starting today. May 1st this week will be World Maternal Mental Health Day. And I think it's important that we draw attention to these and, you know, these topics, because sometimes moms feel alone and we think that our intrusive thoughts are, you know, just something that we are going through and no one else. So let's continue that conversation. But more importantly, in today's conversation, let's find out how to be more proactive, not only as individuals, but as friends and as a society. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Tina Montreuil and Nathalie. Welcome back to the Curious Neuron podcast, everyone. I am joined by two very special guests, Nathalie and Dr. Tina Montreuil. Welcome to the podcast. Nathalie, it's your first time and I'm excited to share your journey with everyone. And Dr. Montreuil, as I said before in the intro, you had been here before. We spoke about emotion regulation skills. Today, we're focusing on mental health in the postpartum period. I'd love for you to share a little bit more about the research that you've been doing and what led us to this conversation.
Yes. Thank you again for having me, Cindy. It's really a pleasure to be returning. So similar as to what we were doing in the past, the idea of right now working in pregnancy, it's still to better equip parents, make them feel that they're capable of facing this transition to parenthood, either for the first time or in some cases, multiple times. But essentially, what we're really focusing on right now is the idea of not simply providing these types of tools to parents once they are parents and they are experiencing challenges, parenting challenges with their children, but sort of a more of a preventive approach is to actually address some potential, parenting challenges, but mostly addressing parental needs during pregnancy and using, the motivation that we have during pregnancy for self-improvement and preparation that often accompanies the prenatal care phase is basically using that motivational aspect to really, equip parents, promote their well-being. And I guess the sort of the theoretical framework to add a big word, but essentially we're basing ourselves on a very sort of well-known model, which is, you know, parents that are doing well socially and emotionally and psychologically will most likely be in a better position to offer parenting, sound parenting, right, more adaptive parenting to children. Right. So that's the only difference. You know, we're doing the same exact thing, supporting parents, but supporting them during pregnancy in preparation for parenthood.
Time and time again, when I speak to parents, this is exactly what they talk about, where the sort of gap is, where they feel like they're sent home with this brand new little human in their arms and they feel equipped in the sense of, well, they've learned how, or they're ready to change diapers or figure out what to do when it comes to sleep, but they don't feel equipped when it comes to their own mental health and their own needs. And sometimes it only hits us a little bit later, right? Where, oh, I thought I had the tools, but I don't have the tools. And I'm so happy that we're going to have this conversation. And this is what led to us bringing up Nathalie, where we really wanted to share somebody's journey. And I think that's what's missing sometimes. Nathalie, welcome. And I would love for you to share your journey, how you came, into contact and connection with Dr. Montreuil and maybe a little bit of your postpartum journey.
Well, thank you for having me. So I'm a mom of a 2-year-old little girl. I had a good pregnancy, so I have nothing to say about this. And I did suffer from depression last fall. So I was back to work and I started to feel some symptoms that I was not myself and I didn't like it. And it led to even at a leave of absence because my mental and physical health, really, I had like a breakdown. And it's been really, really tough, the return to work. And in fall, so looking for some resource, help, or anything, I kind of just dropped on the on Tina's work on the web, and I already told Tina, I already thanked her, because I was finding that someone is doing work, someone is doing research on that, and so important, and gave me hope that, someday prevention will be there. Someday parents might not live what I have lived. And that's how I connect with her. They were asking for some messages or testimony of people, of mom and dad living it. And so I reached out to them, not knowing if I would really receive an answer, but they did. And we connect like this. And I felt so, I felt understood. I felt listened. And for once I felt that, okay, there's someone who understands what I'm living. And it's going to use, it's going to be using what I'm living right now to maybe have better tools in the future. So that's how I connect with Tina. So thank you again, Tina, for working on this. It's important. Really.
Thank you so much. And I think, you know, I would say reciprocally, it's so critical to have people like you that are so inspiring and Natalie to be able to inform our work as well.
Well, thank you.
The parents that are listening, I know that something has stood out to them. You mentioned last fall and that your child is two. I think when a lot of parents think of the postpartum period and postpartum depression or anxiety, that it happens soon after we have that child. But you're talking about a year or more later, right? When you started seeing symptoms?
Yes. I went back to work after 30 months of mat leave. So before that, I didn't, of course, I had ups and downs like everybody else. You know, the body and the mind is changing. So of course, there were days that I didn't feel myself. But the next day, or just looking at my baby smiling, and I was feeling better. But it was really when I got back to work that I had symptoms. And I think one of the things is that I realized how much a maternity and parenting changes us. And I didn't expect that at work also. It was like a bit frustrating that, oh my God, okay, even at work, I'm not the same person, you know. So I didn't like that. And more of this, I had really real symptoms of depression that I knew it was symptoms of that. It's not right after giving birth. It can be later. And I knew about it. I heard about it before. I just didn't expect that I was into that. And when I tried to talk about it, you know, I was not afraid of just saying, I don't feel myself. Right. I don't know what to do. People just answered, oh, you'll see, it's normal. This is parenting. This is having a child is tough, but it'll pass. Hold on. I'm like, okay, it's normal.
Right.
I'll wait.
And that's the word we need to focus on, right? So many parents, whether it's your first, your second, or your third, sometimes we have these emotions and it's really hard. I've spoken to some parents who look up the symptoms online to know, like, am I perhaps experiencing postpartum depression or anxiety? But then when they read them, they're not even sure at that point. They're like, well, sometimes, maybe, I'm not sure. And they speak to parents or, you know, other parents or friends in their community, and they're told, it's normal, I went through that. And then nothing happens. So this is something that we wanted to also make sure we highlight, where being, we're trying to normalize, you know, certain mental health symptoms, but are we actually turning it into something that's not allowing somebody to get the help that they need, right? Dr. Montreuil, what do you see on your end, you know, when it comes to clients or the research? Normalizing, I know it's coming from a good place. Like, we're trying to make people feel like, well, we all experience these symptoms of anxiety. I went through this as well after my first. But then at what point do we need to take action as a parent or speak to someone?
Yeah, so I think it's so critical. And that's what really inspired me from what Natalie was saying. She's like, you know, I recognize it. I wasn't quite sure, but I knew I had to speak about it. And I think that's the thing. Like, we have to really, you know, I guess for people like Natalie, you know, she was upfront, she came, she discussed, she reached out. For other people, that's not their experience. Right. For them, like, we need to almost create a safe space around, you know, mental health issues more generally, but especially create a space. And I think this is our responsibility as clinicians and researchers to really create a space where perhaps we are facilitating this dialogue on mental health issue or just psychological distress if the mental health, you know, piece is ostracizing or stigmatizing. Right. You know, I think one of the things that is noticeable is that, you know, we know literature, you know, we see it. There's the visual, like, you know, that all the physical aspect of pregnancy that, you know, it's visible, our body changes, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. During pregnancy, there are neuroanatomical changes. And I feel we often talk about those neuroanatomical changes, those hormonal changes, in a way that, you know, promotes nurturing. And that's true, like attunement to our baby. So we really sort of depict it on an evolutionary basis, why those are good. But what if for some people, you know, those changes actually trigger some changes in terms of, you know, endocrine changes, hormonal changes that actually, you know, maybe suppress the, you know, serotonin, right, you know, release and secretion, where that would impede on our sentiment or impression of being happy and content, and combine that with the environmental changes, you know, the true hardship of, you know, what comes with sleep deprivation and, you know, not knowing what is the best course of action. And so I would even say, add to that, if your experience of parenting, you receiving the parenting, was not a positive one, you come with those sort of standards of, or fears, I should say, about, you know, sort of predisposing factor about how yourself, perhaps, right, as a parent and your parenting approaches will be compromised. So I think one of the things that I want to highlight is this issue of needing to create a space. Because currently what's happening is that, you know, I highlighted some of the changes that happen. Mm-hmm. And there's almost this notion that once you give birth to that baby, you know, basically your body goes back to reset pre-pregnancy. But I think that has to be questioned. Maybe for some that's the case, but I think many experts would argue that some of those changes are permanent for some. And so therefore that means that perhaps, you know, even at the health level, it's going to cause lifelong changes in the woman's health. And then there's that one thing about, you know, the aspect of permanent changes as a result of pregnancy or not. And then there's the other piece that, you know, once your baby is born, you know, the care is turned towards the baby. Mm. The baby will have periodic appointments postnatally. And what I've heard a lot from women and birthing people is that essentially, you know, what happens to me? You know, where is my space? And then there's sort of that social expectation that if I were to say that I'm not well, or sort of claim that maternal or that sort of parental space, that it might actually be maybe an indicator that I'm not really caring as much for my baby as others. So there's almost that stigma, not just around mental health issues or psychological distress, but also perhaps stigma around I'm wanting space when really now I'm a mom and it should all be about my baby. So I think we have to question, you know, like we, and Natalie is the one that actually inspired us to think that way. You know, we prepare so much for the prenatal phase of the child, the mother as a receptacle of this living being that is being formed. And then once we give birth, you know, there's not really a systemic plan nor a medical plan in place to really care for the mom and her health and her capacity, as I was going back to the introduction, to parent. So this whole aspect of parental well-being, maternal well-being, in order to be able to ensure the sustained well-being of that child as we're facing these parenting challenges.
I know that so many parents feel seen with what you just said and feel like this needs to happen sooner than later, you know, that sort of support for the parents. Is it like that across all cultures? I just had this idea pop into my mind because I know that I've spoken to some people in Northern Europe or other countries that feel that either it's a cultural thing where there's more of that family support once you have a child and the family sort of comes together to support that new parent, new mom. And then after I've heard some people talk about like, not a doula, but some sort of person that comes with you and stays with you. That's part of the healthcare system so that the mom has somebody there to do the laundry. It's not a family member. It's truly part of the healthcare system. So are we lagging behind here in North America?
So definitely a lot of the models of care, of prenatal care and postpartum care, if we look at models like models that have you know, like I would say models that have a lot of guidelines in place in terms of postpartum care that align with the World Health Organization's recommendations, which is, you know, to have between 3 to 6 visits postnatally as a minimum, right? Which is, in essence, that's really not what's taking place in North America. No. But, you know, countries like Australia, countries like the UK, where, again, the midwifery takes or has a good portion of the care of mother and child during pregnancy, but also postpartum, it's clear in our experience working with midwives in the Montreal area and also our connections across Canada that, you know, the type of care, the framework in which midwifery is exercised. When I was talking before about creating a space for dialogue, for, you know, sort of almost like, empathy, you know, a working relationship, caters more to that sort of postpartum, right, or I would say ideal postpartum care. It doesn't mean that in, let's say, our first care or in the medical system that we wouldn't be able to do that, but it would require some sort of a shift. And in the care provider's defense, you know, we work very closely with them as well. I think a lot of them, you know, nurses, physicians, they have a desire to service women postpartum. But I think what's really lacking is perhaps the knowledge, the mental health piece. Like, how do we assess? How do we assess in a way that's not going to be confrontational, or it's not going to be, for example, or it's going to be culturally adapted, since we're on that question, right? So I think we also have to ask ourselves the question, like, you know, what else could be done in this space to actually, you know, provide that care for women like myself, like you, like Nathalie, in order to ensure that ultimately, you know, we're going to be better prepared, not only for conception, but for the job of being a parent. So that's the whole debate there.
Right. That word better prepared, Nathalie, you mentioned this before, where you just felt like you needed those tools. Looking back now and knowing what you know now because of the work that you've been doing with Dr. Montreuil, what needs to change for new moms and new parents? What would you have needed in that time?
Well, first, yes, try to avoid that thinking that once you give birth, the body and the mom just goes back to what she was before and just ignore. It's really, it's fascinating, you know, that when someone gives birth and you ask, how's the baby? Yeah, how's the mom? How's
what
the
about
dad?
Me?
You just forget it. But it continues after. So that shocked me. So if we could stop, you know, ignoring the parents and just, and stop just focusing on the baby. I don't think I can really say what exactly needs to be done, but just provide space where the parents could ask themselves, am I okay? Or someone just ask them, are you okay? Because I was not led to ask myself during, and I said my depression started at work. Maybe it started before, but I just don't know it. My symptoms started because I was at work. But maybe it was before. Yeah. I just didn't ask myself. Yeah. And I just don't even know how. It's not something that we ask ourselves daily. Am I doing okay today? No. So, and I still don't understand how come every month I was going to see a doctor or a nurse to see if my baby's okay. No one ever asked me. No one ever looked me in the eyes like, you, are you okay? Physically, mentally, just a simple question that could have made the difference. And just think about people who are isolated. I'm not. I was doing my boyfriend, my family, my friends. Just think about people who don't have access to those doctors and nurse, or don't have access to families and are isolated. They less think about asking themselves, am I doing okay? So just that space of thinking of am I doing okay? It's not existing.
Right. And you were also proactive in yourself, right? Where you started doing the research, and not everybody might think about doing that, or some people might retreat and go back a little bit and just kind of isolate themselves a little bit more. And like you said, when we were talking last time, we also brought up accessibility versus availability. And I think we need to bring that up, because with what you just said, right? If somebody was in a different area here of the province that didn't have access to Dr. Montreuil's work or was close to the university, would they have been able to get the help that you got?
Probably not. And even for myself, like I asked myself, it was too late. I was already in depression. What if I would have had some resources or help just before getting to that point that I would have symptoms? But I didn't, because I didn't ask myself. I didn't have any resource or any books about it. So the resources exist, because I found it out in the fall when I was in it. And that's how I connect with Tina. So it's not because they don't exist. The accessibility is there. It's just not at, it might not be at the right moment. And that's the proactive way that I don't feel that I've been that proactive, saying, knowing that it led to a leave of absence. Right. At least I might have been a bit proactive. So I left for just 2 months. I didn't leave for a whole year. So might have been a little bit proactive, but I don't feel I've been that much.
I get that.
No.
You know, we talked about the normalization piece of, you know, somebody, people telling, you know, us that it's normal and these symptoms happen to everybody. You know, I've spoken to some moms who felt some rage out of nowhere during the postpartum period and felt so embarrassed and shamed, not only in their relationship of this rage coming out of nowhere, but they didn't want to talk to people about it. There are so many different symptoms that people might isolate or not want to talk about, even self-harm or harming their child too. People would not want to, there's some moms who shared with me that, you know, they don't want anything to happen like with social services, you know, like if you say that you had these intrusive thoughts. Dr. Montreuil, is this common? Like, because a lot of these symptoms might feel embarrassing or shameful to a parent, or they have guilt around it. What would you recommend or suggest to that person who's listening and has these thoughts? And because of those thoughts, they're not sharing what they're really feeling with the people around them.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're very true. And this is an experience I've had as well, both, you know, conducting either, you know, mixed methods or qualitative like interviews where we connect with people like Natalie and others who have experienced either just more generally mental health distress or psychological distress, or specifically surrounding the perinatal and transition to parenthood. So it's very frightening, because for a lot of people, like I said, for some people, it's just the anticipation that because, you know, I was sort of on the receiving end of poor parenting, that perhaps all these sort of beliefs about, you know, this, the fact that I'll be limited myself if I didn't get a good parenting, then probably I'll replicate the same thing. And I know for some parents, just that thought of replicating this sort of intergenerational deprivation or you know, maladaptive parenting is very distressful. And then there's just combined with that where, you know, like we are often, I was doing a presentation yesterday and, you know, kind of showing the image of like a lot of the times on, you know, this will be on social media and it'll be, and this is the good side of social media, but sometimes social media projects an unrealistic expectation. I was talking about attunement before, like the mom that is smiling and sort of like cuddling and sort of like, you know, lifting the baby as if, you know, it's this marvel. And certainly parenthood is filled with those moments. But for a lot of parents, you know, it's being, there was another picture that I was displaying of a mother, you know, sort of lying on her back with the baby crying next to her and sort of being overwhelmed and not knowing how to deal with this. And probably in that very moment, if I were to put thoughts in that person's mind, it's like, I can't handle this. I'm going to basically, you know, mark or, you know, affect my child's well-being forever. And the same goes for fathers. Let's not forget them, right? Like the notion that, you know, maybe in this case, it's also, I can't support my partner. I can't provide the assistance. And a lot of times, like just to throw in a little word there for our fathers there, is that a lot of the times they haven't had like the experience of parenthood, or I should say the experience of pregnancy for them is very external. You know, they're not experiencing these sort of biological and biophysiological changes that somehow kind of get us as mothers or as birthing people to kind of get prepared for the, you know, the reality of this transition. Whereas for fathers, a lot of the times being more on the outside of this, they almost, we're talking about beliefs, they can maybe tell themselves that they don't get their partners, that, you know, they're not equipped for this. And then, so therefore, I think, you know, what we're essentially saying, and maybe I can come back with this aspect of, you know, availability versus acceptability. I think, you know, there is an advantage in not just promoting the child or promoting, you know, the person here, but promoting the unit, you know, like if the system is stronger, then essentially most likely each and every individual part of that system will also be reinforced. Mm-hmm. And this is speaking to the importance of really promoting, the importance of family and families under all of its colors and shapes and definitions, right? But this notion of, you know, strong family units. And this brings us back to this idea of accessibility and availability. So I guess, you know, we might have some time later to mention a few key resources. Natalie came to us through the Quebec Alliance of Perinatal Mental Health, but there's certainly, for example, a very good colleague of mine, Marie-Claude Dufour, who leads the Réseau des CRP, which is des Centres de Ressources Perinatales du Québec, which they have amazing resources. More recently, we contributed to Le Livre Blanc de la Périnatalité, which is essentially, like, you know, it's filled with like evidence-based research, but it's written in lay terms to be accessible to mm-hmm. all. And it contains a plethora of resources mm-hmm. for parents. So I think for me, that's the thing. I think we really have to promote support of mothers, definitely postnatally, but also like, what are we doing to support families as well?
You know, I'm going to oversimplify the next steps for this, but I remember leaving the hospital and I had this very heavy book about like, what's going to, I forget what it's called, like 0 to 5 or
mieux vivre avec son enfant.
Oui, exact. So it was, it, you know, and it was a really heavy book, but I don't remember there. Yes. I don't remember them talking about everything that we just talked about. Isn't there space for another one of these huge books or just a pamphlet with some of this information to get us started and towards positive changes? And I guess my question's to both of you, but Natalie, would that have made, you know, because I'm thinking about myself as well, like just knowing about the resources that we just heard from, you know, that Dr. Montreuil talked about, just knowing that is a good start, right, Natalie?
It's a good point. And the first time I heard about depression, postpartum mm-hmm. depression, was at Tout le monde en parle a few mm-hmm. years ago, way before I was even thinking about having mm-hmm. children. It was from Jessica Barker. She pointed out that in that book, at that time, there was half a page. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. remember that the book is like huge. This yeah. big. So there was half, it's yeah. a huge, but the page I released are like half a real page. There was half a page about depression, but I don't know how many page about how to latch right. or to. So and it was proving how there was a lack of information or in prevention. I didn't look at mine a few years after to have more page, but of course, I read it, and like I said, it didn't really prepare me that what's going to be the symptom, when should I consult, who should I talk to? So yes, there are space, yeah. you know, it's not completely, I don't think it's silly right. to think that we could use the tools we have right now, just like this book, or maybe the appointment I had personally with the doctors or nurses just to ask me, are you doing okay? So I think there are some tools right now.
Yeah.
What's blocking? I don't know.
Tina, are we oversimplifying?
Yeah. Well, yes. Just to answer your question about, like, you know, Jessica Parker, who's a great person that we is a great supporter of this cause. And I think she's definitely carried this this mission at a Quebec level, if not more Canada-wide. But essentially, Yes, we did the exercise. It's about like now, I think currently about maybe a page, if let's say a page and a half. So certainly there's room for improvement when we consider the 400 other pages in there. Because I think what people need to understand is like this idea that, you know, maybe I have, let's say, 25 pages about, you know, how to bathe the baby, how to wrap the baby. But if mentally I'm not doing well, if psychologically I'm depleted, it doesn't matter if I have all this information. I can't consolidate it. I can't read through it. I don't have the volition to actually carry it out. And I've had a number of people, you know, like via research or even in my office as a clinician, you know, tell us this. So the idea is that, you know, this sort of like the mind over mood, we have these principles in psychology by Podesky and Greenberger that are saying that, you know, in order to have, for example, the impression that we can do something, that we're doing well, like it needs to be sort of like preceded by, you know, like a certain mindset. Right. And then, you know, we need to be able to carry out those actions. And then through those actions, we get reinforced. But certainly there's room for improvement. And I think on that, what I would want to say, and there was one thing that it was actually informed by Natalie, we had this conversation, because I guess for me as a clinical psychologist that's trained to implement interventions that are using a sort of cognitive behavioral therapy framework, mm-hmm. we use a lot of psychoeducation. We were talking earlier in this podcast about normalization mm-hmm. and, you know, mental health literacy. And there was something, I remember sitting there in that kind of like virtual meeting when Natalie meeting her on the first time, and she said something, I hope it's okay if I paraphrase you, Natalie, because for me, it was a game changer. It opened my eyes to an important limitation that we have. And that is, you know, she said something along the lines that, you know, mental health literacy in the absence of actual resources mm-hmm. and means, so strategies or tools actually has a perverse effect mm-hmm. to which I had to ask her, can you just explain to me? And so in to use your words, Natalie was like, basically like after a while, when you keep on hearing that it's normal and that others feel this way, it comes a time, and probably you could best explain it, Natalie, but it comes to a time where you're like, okay, well, it's been a while and I'm still not doing well, but I'm told that things is normal and things should technically improve. So if I'm not improving, mm-hmm. like what's wrong with you?
Yeah,
but in effect, like you're not being provided with tools. Mm-hmm. And so as a clinician, a psychologist, not a physician, mm-hmm. like in a framework that I work and I operate in, we use literacy, we use mental health and normalization. But that's just to create the alliance, mm-hmm. you know, create that space to make the person feel secure and to say, you know what, like, take down your guards, you know, like there's nothing wrong with you. This is very normal. But that's just to kind of create that connection. And quickly as psychologists, as mental health experts, we go into, okay, here's what you can do. There's more passive approach, for example, like mindfulness and relaxation. And then there's more sort of active things that you can do, such as like, for example, cognitive restructuring, more mindfulness-based and acceptance and tolerating distress. So we provide, very quickly, we provide tools. Mm. And it made me reflect that a lot of the times in a lot of our campaigns, we just kind of like are okay with doing a lot of mental health literacy, which is good. But then what comes next? And this is what we're talking about now. Where are my tools? Where are they available? And how come I have to become sick to actually get those resources when in effect they were available, you know, before I got ill, right. but I just could not access them. So obviously mental health literacy is critical. But it's not sufficient right. to really provide the help that suffering and, you know, sort of like motivated parents need in a time, in a critical time, which is like early infancy.
Yeah.
And I would add that even if it's accessible, like in that book, you're saying that there may be one page, a page and a half, but there's still more information out to bait. In my mind, and probably in everybody's mind, if that there's that information on bathing and that information on health, it gives me the idea of the risk of baiting is much higher than the risk of hell. It's more, it's more important that the risk of happening will be higher in baiting than in mental health. So of course you're not lead to ask yourself or to get into action of I'm not doing okay. And you're being told it's normal. You're not lead. You're not led to do some action. Right. And then you just go on. I could tell you there was someone saying the two first years are the toughest. So I was so, and I didn't, I was not well. So I was secretly hoping that if I hold on those 2 years and at the second birth of my, my girl, it was all, it would all suddenly disappearing.
Dissipate.
It's completely silly, but I wasn't that mind saying, okay, those 2 years, those 2 years.
You're waiting for it. But Nathalie, thank you for saying that, because that's a question I was going to ask as well. I'm sure that there are parents listening to this saying, okay, so if I'm noticing a difference or a lack of motivation or something is off and I know something is off, do I just let it pass? Is it a moment that's going to pass, right? Like, am I going to get through it with time passing? And what I'm hearing from you, Nathalie, and from what I understood with Dr. Montreuil, is we can't. We need to take action.
Well, it will pass, but don't let it, don't just do nothing. Just don't expect that it'll go away by itself. Just as anything else in the world, if you're hurt, you will get, if you catch yourself, you get to, you'll get better, but you'll probably put a plaster or something. So yes, talk about it. Don't worry about it. Yes, it'll pass. It passed for me, but take some actions. Look at your, ask yourself, what could you do for yourself, for your mental health? Talk to your partner, talk to your friends, your family, but don't just do nothing. It won't go away.
And if people tell you that it's normal, or a doctor perhaps dismisses it and says, like, it's part of the phase, you know, maybe we have to be a little bit more proactive in that sense of pushing to get support and help.
Yes, to go to action. So yes, it's normal. Don't feel that you're the weak person, you're the weak mother, or you're a bad one mother or a bad father. So that part of normalization, I think it's, well, it helped me at first saying, okay, I'm living a normal phase. But what I'm saying, that normal phase shouldn't lead to don't do nothing. Mm-hmm. Do something to get better.
And I'm really happy you brought up that word, the weakness, right? Because I've heard this through, we spoke with Dr. DaCosta, who's also a Montreal, a McGill professor, and she was talking about dads and how they felt, you know, they didn't go through all of that and they shouldn't have symptoms, you know, postpartum depression or anxiety, or feel like this is difficult. And they felt like it was showing weakness, right? And a mom might feel that as well. Like, I need to be able to do it all. And if I can't, or I feel sad, or I feel overwhelmed, like, that means I'm not good enough at what I'm doing, or I am showing signs of weakness. That is such an important word for us to say, because I know it'll help parents feel seen, because they're not, it's not a weakness to experience this.
And I would even argue, like, for a lot of parents, I would say, like, I often tell parents, and we have this intervention that we're doing, obviously not perinatally at the moment, but, you know, one of them is just, it's called parenting with confidence. And one of the things that, you know, you'd be surprised just by telling parents, like, yes, it's normal, but also telling them, listen, the fact that you're, you know, you're questioning your ability as a parent, the fact that you're struggling in and of itself, you know, just frame it differently. It's evidence that you are a good parent because you're caring. That's driven by the fact that you're so concerned about, you know, the care that you wish your child to have, that essentially it's causing you distress. So when we're going back to the weak, you know, let's reappraise this weakness as, you know what, like, I'm just concerned. I just actually care. I don't know how, but because I care, I'm going to, you know, like, my child is worth it. I'm worth it. I am a good parent. And you know what, I will seek help. So I think, you know, one of the things that, and we see just the fact that we're just changing the labels. Right. We haven't done much yet. But we're just basically like telling parents that, you know, that in and of itself is evidence that you're a good parent. And most parents out there, even if you're not doing exactly what might be best for your child or what you would want to do for your child, a lot of it is just because, you know, we're bombarded with so much information mm-hmm. that we're not quite sure. But I would tell you that most parents that I've met are parents that actually are good parents. Mm-hmm. Intentfully, there are good parents. There's just, you know, either too much information, how do I know? Or there's for some people, now we're talking about Natalie, you're fortunate enough to have a family support, you know, like friends, and you're well educated, and, you know, you're someone that is resourceful. And all those are individual, what we call social determinants of well-being and in health. Mm-hmm. For some people in certain demographics and, you know, new arrivants that arrive to Canada, which they're more socially isolated, mm-hmm. maybe that, you know, their social economical status is lower. Maybe they're even, you know, we've done a study with CHSSN, which is, you know, a community conglomerate or services that offer support to, you know, non-French speaking Quebecers. So English speaking Quebecers in the province, essentially even language. Mm-hmm. Language is something that basically also interferes with your access to right. care.
Yeah.
So essentially, I think, you know, there's Natalie's, if Natalie had difficulty with who she is, accessing resources, it's clear that for other communities or individuals or demographics in the province and across Canada, access to, you know, the timely resources is an issue. Mm-hmm. So when you were saying, yes, things do get better, but unfortunately, I can tell you working with, for example, the Canadian Perinatal Mental Health Collaborative, that for some women, the outcome is not a favorable one. And so we can't just, you know, just sit on the fact that they're going to find resources. Yeah. Like, what are we doing proactively, like you said, mm-hmm. Cindy, to actually make those resources like at their disposal? If you allow me to just yeah. add as well, you know, like when we're, you know, immediate postpartum, you know, what's the protocol of care? You know, like we basically have the parents test. We check to make sure that the car seat is not mm-hmm. expired. We make sure that parents know how to buckle the children adequately in the car seat. We also talk about the shaken baby yes. syndrome protocol. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, what precedes that? You know, if you want the parent to be calm and be able to feel competent to put that baby in their car seat, if you want the parent to be we talk about emotion regulation, mm-hmm. if we want the parents to be regulated and be able to have the emotional space to deal with a crying baby that is just not consolable, mm-hmm. you know, and not resort to shaking their child. Mm-hmm. It's all about mental health and psychological balance. So for me, I always question, I think those protocols are amazing, but it just makes sense to me, or rather I'll say on the flip side, it makes little sense to me why we can't have that dialogue yeah. while we have the parents under the care to basically empower them to feel better equipped mm-hmm. or at least know where to go for resources. You were talking about a pamphlet, right. Natalie.
Yeah.
So that speaks to that as well.
At the very least, right? That pamphlet. But we are there. They are with us. They are, you know, we are at the hospital. And I do remember for all three kids, they went through that shaken baby syndrome and the protocol for that. Yeah. What would be my action plan? And if it and I'm glad that they did that, but it's not addressing why you would want to do that and the emotion aspect of that and the mental health aspect of that, which I experienced after my kids as well, after the first, I know some parents that are listening, it's like, whew, nothing happened. I'm okay. I have my second now. But for me, it was after the second and the third where it just kept getting worse mm-hmm. because I ignored my mental health after my second and had a baby soon after. So it just kind of like amplified itself. And I do think that mm-hmm. it's important that we keep talking about that. And for myself, even after I stopped nursing, I had nursed for a few years in a row because I had babies so close that when I stopped nursing, I went into a depression, not even understanding what was going on. And only when I started talking about it, people said, hey, I experienced that too. And I didn't even understand what had happened to me, you know? So I do think that there's lots of space for it's not the literacy part, but it's more of the action plan. This might happen to you. You might feel this way. Yes, it's okay. But now what, right? Like that's the part that's mm-hmm. missing. That's exactly what we need to focus on. So I yes. do think there's a lot of room for that.
Yes.
Yeah. I unfortunately have to end this conversation. I really don't want to. Both of you have been truly important for this conversation and have added such an amazing part of this dialogue. I do want to end this conversation on a positive note, perhaps for parents that are listening. What are the next steps? So parents listening to this, perhaps they're expecting their first, they're waiting, perhaps they're expecting their second and have one at home and they're starting to feel that something is off. Maybe we can start with you, Nathalie. Like, what advice do you have for this parent moving forward? And then we can follow that up with Dr. Montreux in terms of like what is possible, or we're going to add a lot of resources to the show notes of this podcast, but you know, in terms of like what the next steps would be for that parent.
Well, like I said before, if you think you're experiencing anything, and even if you think you're not experiencing depression, think about yourself. Being a good mom, a good dad is also being good in health, mentally and physically. So if you think you're experiencing anything, go talk and try to see what's best for you and the baby also. So if it's taking a day off or I don't know it, and it's good also for going back to work. When you'll go back to work, try to see with your manager and your team what's best for a good return to work. Going back to work day one as a professional, as the professional world before, well, you might think it's really hard after 12 months of a mat leave. So try to see and talk about what can be done so it's easier to get back to work or to get into a life of a mom or dad. You know, try to adapt and try to adapt your baby, but try to adapt your life as a new mom, as a new dad. It's possible. There's no one size fits all. So that's what
I would
say.
And I think I just want to add to that, like some parents will say like my relationship has changed or I'm struggling now with my relationship. So it's not necessarily that I'm feeling, you know, symptoms of depression or anxiety, but I'm feeling overwhelmed. There's an emotion that's being amplified because of this new baby. I'm feeling overwhelmed with my relationship. You know, we're struggling with conflict resolution. All of that adds to our emotional and mental health, right? So I think it is that in terms of looking at our overall life, maybe even with a parent, you know, like an in-law, something is happening. We have a new baby. Lots of parents and in-laws have advice for us sometimes. And that adds to the stress.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes.
And Dr. Montreux, knowing, you know, Nathalie, what she was saying, but what would you add to that from a clinical and a research perspective?
So 3 points. First point, what I would say is that essentially that taking care of yourself is caring for your baby and your child.
Thank you.
So basically that is so important. Mm. It's not like it's not something selfish. Right. It's the analogy. I've been talking about this, airline mask in case of emergency analogy since 2015. So that's not new for me, but it's become a bit more like sort of popular during since post-COVID. But essentially this notion that we understand when we're on a flight that if we are to try to put on our child's mask, because that's what parents or, you know, or even for our elders, we'd be inclined to helping the powerless, that essentially if we're going to be running out of oxygen, and here the oxygen parallel to psychological well-being is kind of emotion regulation, is like, you know, being at an optimal mental health or psychological capacity. If I'm to run out of oxygen, well, I won't be able to actually help my child or whoever else is weaker or in a more powerless position than I. We get that. We would do it, right? So the same goes, like looking after your own well-being as a mom, as a new mom. You know, it is not selfish. It's an act of love towards yourself.
Exactly.
And we know that from, like, for example, like a lot of, you know, DBT, you know, dialect therapy, behavioral therapy, you know, it's like self-love is basically being able afterwards to care for others. You're caring for yourself because you're caring for your baby. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say that goes with that is self-compassion. You know, parenting is messy. It's messy, but it's also beautiful because it's an opportunity to grow as an individual, right? You're learning about yourself through those interactions with that little child that is so small, but yet, you know, brings about so many elements, you know, where we're, you know, no one else would, we would never put up with any of that, you know, if it wasn't our own, you know, our own offspring, our own child, right? So use a lot of self-compassion. It's not going to be perfect. But you know what? There's beauty in, for example, the second time or the third time, right? And stop worrying about, you know, having had one negative reaction, right? You know, it's really sort of an additive thing. You know, if it's more often negative than not, like Natalie said, do seek help. But if once in a while, you know, you slip, that's part of parenting. And we know it's like any other sport. If I told you I would win a marathon tomorrow when I've never, you know, practiced for it, you'd say, Tina, that's ridiculous. Well, the same thing as parents, like, you know, this is all new to us, you know, like no one's really trained us to do this job. And I would say, lastly, I would be hopeful because we're in an era now where we're talking more and more about it. And I really feel that in the next couple of years, a lot is going to happen in this space of perinatal and postpartum mental health in terms of parenting. Like I'm involved with various projects at, you know, the provincial level. There's going to be like some exciting things coming up in terms of resources. Decision makers are hearing, have heard. So I think if anything, if, you know, there's been times in maybe like in the past couple years where things have been difficult. I really do feel that there's a lot of new things that are going to be arising or developing in this sphere of perinatal mental health and everything having to do with the transition to parenthood. Our minister, Ms. Kalma, is very, very connected with the reality of parents. So it's very encouraging. So I would say, you know, with all those three aspects, I think there's a lot to just be hopeful for, and you know, let's build a community. That's right. The whole point about these community resources. Let's build a community. Let's access these community organizations that are there to provide support if you don't have a family.
Right, exactly. I will add all of those resources down in the show notes so people can click on it and get them, you know, get the accessibility to them. Dr. Montreuil just mentioned self-compassion. I interviewed Dr. Kristen Neff. I'm going to add that to the show notes as well. Her work is pivotal around that.
Amazing.
So I just want to say thank you to both of you. This conversation was amazing. And I have a feeling there'll be a follow-up at some point because it is an important one. So thank you to both of you again.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you so much, Cindy, for the opportunity.
And thank you, Natalie.
Thank you so much. You know, you're wonderful.
You're welcome.